My name is Michael McCusker. As you probably are aware, March is Women's History Month. And I do believe March 8th, which would be Saturday, is International Women's Day. But I might be off a date or two for that. But at any rate, I'd like to read something that I usually read this time of year. I first titled it Ms. Smith Goes to Washington, because I wrote it for the 2000 presidential election, hoping a woman would be the first American president of the new millennium, but that didn't occur, nor has it yet. At any rate, I'd like to read this that I wrote, so I have to probably give the disclaimer that this is my opinion and my opinion only in the entire cosmos. And I'd like to start with a quote by Eleanor Roosevelt. Women must get into the political game and stay in it. Women have contributed hugely to American history, but as it is with blacks and others who have helped build this nation, their contributions have been ignored and undervalued. Even before Europeans settled in the Americas, American women were powerful forces in their separate communities and tribal councils. Iroquois women owned the land and controlled the economy by supervising the distribution of food. The Cherokee Women's Council helped select male leaders, declared war, and determined the fate of captives. In 1540, Spanish explorer Hernando de Soto was welcomed in present-day Georgia by a woman chieftain who gave him a string of pearls. Perhaps the beginning of the present-day women's movement was in 1640, when Anne Hibbins of Boston insisted she had the right to complain about male carpenters she had hired. Church elders attacked her for thinking she could handle such affairs better than her husband, which is a plain breach of the rule of Christ. She was excommunicated and was hanged for witchcraft 16 years later. Women agitated for equality long before the American Revolution. A group of women complained in a letter to the New York Journal in 1733, "We are housekeepers, pay our taxes, carry on trade, and most of us are she merchants, and as we in some measure contribute to the support of government, we ought to be entitled to some of the sweets of it." As a result of a successful case by the Virginia slave, a Virginia slave in 1655, that she was a free woman because her father was white, southern colonies, including Virginia, declared that all newborn African Americans were slaves regardless of the parents' status. A century later, another woman won her freedom in Massachusetts after arguing that she was illegally enslaved because her mother was white, which meant she was born free. In 1701, six men and six women were selected for an Albany, New York jury, which was an exception. During much of American history, women were kept off juries. Not until 1975 did the U.S. Supreme Court rule that women's automatic exemption from jury duty is unconstitutional. Many other instances of women defying religious and royalist male authority occurred before the Revolution. Hopes were high among many women that the revolution would be truly revolutionary and allow them equal status. But liberty for all was selective and left out women and slaves of both sexes and, as it turned out, working class people as well. In the new code of laws, which I suppose it will be necessary for you to make, I desire you would remember the ladies and be more generous and favorable to them than your ancestors, Abigail Adams wrote in a 1776 letter to her husband John, a delegate to the rebel Congress in Philadelphia. Do not put such unlimited power into the hands of husbands, she wrote. Remember, all men would be tyrants if they could. If particular care and attention is not paid to the ladies, we are determined to foment a rebellion and will not hold ourselves bound by any laws in which we have no voice or representation. During the Revolution, women served on battle lines, manned cannon, such as the famous Molly Pitcher, who took over a cannon when her husband was shot. Of course, there were many Molly Pitchers. Nursed wounded and cooked for the militias and regular troops. City women raised money for food and clothes for Washington's ragtag army. In the meantime, frontier women fought Indians, unleashed on western settlements by the British. In 1777, several Daughters of Liberty stripped a man who criticized the Revolution, covered him with molasses, and stuck on dozens of flower petals. Philadelphia women in 1780 called for action in a broadside titled The Sentiments of American Women. They described themselves as born for liberty, disdaining to bear the irons of a tyrannic government. In 1787, the new United States Constitution left the determination of who was eligible to vote to the states, but did not specifically bar women from holding federal office. States' rights meant then as now limited participation or none by those outside the white male status quo. New Jersey's state constitution gave the vote to all property owners worth a certain amount, which left wives as well as unmarried women ineligible. However, the state's election law was briefly revised in 1790 and referred to voters as he or she. New York specifically denied voting rights to women in its constitution in 1777, and other states quickly followed suit. Thomas Jefferson, principal author of the Declaration of Independence, which the month of July is annually obliged to celebrate, said as president in response to a suggestion in 1807 by Secretary of the Treasury Albert Gallatin, "The appointment of a woman to office is an innovation for which the public is not prepared, nor am I." Is the needle sufficient? Judith Sargent Murray wrote in her essay On the Equality of the Sexes, which appeared in Massachusetts Magazine in 1790. Writing under the name Constantia, she argued that women's and men's mental abilities were equal and proposed full education for women. Will it be said that the judgment of a male of 2 years is more sage than that of a female's of the same age? She wrote. I believe the reverse is generally observed to be true. But from that period, what partiality? How is the one exalted and the other depressed by the contrary modes of education which are adopted? Grant that their minds are by nature equal, yet who shall wonder at the apparent superiority? The 19th century began with women voting in substantial numbers in the 1800 presidential election. But in 1807, New Jersey changed its election law once more by inserting the words white and male into its voting requirements, and women were not permitted to hold office in any of the states. In a manner similar to the civil rights movement of the 1960s, producing white anti-Vietnam War activists, the women's rights movement of the 19th century converged from the pre-Civil War abolitionist movement. Men initially controlled abolitionist groups, but frustrated women broke off and formed their own abolitionist societies, which generally included black as well as white women. In 1825, Scottish-born Frances Fanny Wright attempted to abolish slavery with a plan for allowing slaves to work on public land and buy their freedom with the profits. Her attempt at setting up a model plantation failed, but 4 years later she set a Hall of Science in a New York City church and lectured on women's rights. Until women assume the place in society which good sense and good feeling alike assign to them, Fanny Wright declared, human improvement must advance but feebly. It is in vain that we would circumscribe the power of one half of our race, and that by far the most important and influential. The newly formed American Anti-Slavery Society refused to admit women members in 1833, but 20 white and black women formed the Philadelphia Anti-Slavery Society. In their constitution, they underlined that slavery and prejudice violated the laws of God and the Declaration of Independence. Charter members included Lucretia Coffin Mott, Esther Moore, Rebecca Buffum, Grace Bustle Douglas, and that's Stephen Douglas's wife, she was black, and Charlotte Fortin and her three daughters, Margaretta, Sarah Louise, and Harriet. The Boston Female Anti-Slavery Society was threatened by a mob when it scheduled abolitionist William Lloyd Garrison as speaker in 1835. When the mayor ordered the women to leave, Maria Weston Chapman replied, "If this is the last bulwark of freedom, we may as well die here as anywhere." The women, white and black, joined hands and walked through the mob to Chapman's home. The first anti-slavery convention of American women was held in New York in May 1837. Of the 200 women who attended, at least 20 were black, and Grace Douglas was elected vice president. And again, the wife of escaped slave Frederick Douglass. The women declared that it was time to move out of their circumscribed limits, and that's a quote, and to use their, quote, pins, purses, and influence to end slavery, unquote. The second convention of the women's anti-slavery group held in Philadelphia the following year was met by an angry rock-throwing mob, which burned down the hall they met in. Lucretia Mott, a convention leader that year, was threatened. But the next day, the women declared, "The prejudice against color is the very spirit of slavery," and urged all abolitionists to sit with African Americans in their places of worship, walk with them on the street, and invite them into their homes. The American Anti-Slavery Society finally gave women voting rights in 1839, and the next year Abigail Foster was nominated to the business committee. Several women, including Lucretia Mott, were sent as delegates to an international slavery conference in London, but the British refused to accept any of them. They were allowed to attend as spectators only, which outraged Elizabeth Cady Stanton, attending with her husband, a U.S. delegate. She had the word obey deleted from her wedding vows earlier that year. Stanton and Mott soon became friends and decided to hold a convention and form a society to advance the rights of women. And that's a quote. In the meantime, Angelina Grimke published an appeal to the women of the normally free states in 1837, the nominally free states. Grimke said in a lecture she and her sister Sarah organized, one of many to large mixed audiences, "I believe it is a woman's right to have a voice in all the laws and regulations by which she is to be governed, whether in church or state, and that the present arrangements of society on these points are a violation of human rights." She added that a woman had as much right as a man to sit in the presidential chair of the United States. Margaret Fuller, a writer and highly regarded intellectual, published her seminal work, Women in the 19th Century, in 1845. She insisted on women's need, quote, as a soul to live freely and unimpeded, and called for an end to even well-meant restrictions. "We would have every arbitrary barrier thrown down," Fuller wrote. "We would have every path laid open to women as freely as to man." And in 1848, 44 women sent a petition demanding that the New York State Legislature repeal its laws affecting women. They argued that the Declaration of Independence stated that governments derive their just powers from the consent of the governed, and as women have never consented to, been represented in, or recognized by this government, it is evident that in justice no allegiance can be claimed from them. In the summer of 1848, the Seneca Falls Convention, perhaps the most famous gathering of American women in the 19th century, was held in Seneca Falls, New York. Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Lucretia Mott, Martha Coffin Wright, Jane Hunt, and Mary Ann McClintock were the principal organizers and were surprised that almost 300 people, mostly women, attended. One of them, Charlotte Woodward, later Pierce, said, "As we reached different crossroads, we saw wagons coming from every part of the country, and long before we reached Seneca Falls, we were a procession." A declaration of sentiments was drafted by Stanton at the convention, modeled after the Declaration of Independence. It condemned women's disenfranchisement, their lack of a voice in the laws they were compelled to obey, restrictions on their education and employment opportunities, their subordination by the church, the use of a moral double standard, and the theft of married women's full property rights. The group then passed a series of general resolutions that called for women's equal rights. A proposal to secure the vote for women narrowly passed after arguments by Stanton and Frederick Douglass, but took more than 70 years to be fulfilled. Only one woman who signed the resolution, Charlotte Woodward, lived to cast her ballot. 2 weeks after Seneca Falls, another meeting in nearby Rochester called for women's enfranchisement, revision of existing property laws, and delegates pledged to help raise working women's wages. Abolitionist women held a women's rights conference in Salem, Ohio, in April 1850. Men were not allowed to speak or vote at the two-day meeting. Women had requested James Mott to preside at Seneca Falls. Men who attempted to voice opinions were ruled out of order. Resolved to claim their rights as human beings, the women sent a petition to the Ohio Constitutional Convention demanding suffrage and all other rights extended to men in the new state constitution. Throughout the 1850s, black women encouraged white women and men with words and actions, in particular the dauntless Harriet Tubman, who continually risked her life to lead Southern slaves to freedom in the North and Canada. "I had crossed the line of which I had so long been dreaming," she said after escaping slavery in 1849. "I was free, but there was no one to welcome me to the land of freedom." William Still described Tubman in his 1872 book about the Underground Railroad as a woman of no pretensions, but in point of courage, shrewdness, and disinterested exertions to rescue her fellow men, she was without her equal. Women served as nurses, spies, and a few posed as men to enlist as regular soldiers on both sides in the Civil War. Foreshadowing the world wars of the next century, women worked in factories to supply the war effort for both the Union and Confederacy. Women also raised money for both armies, organized relief work for wounded and prisoners of war, and helped establish nursing as a profession. When the Emancipation Proclamation freed slaves only in the Confederacy and not in slaveholding Union states during the Civil War, Susan B. Anthony, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Ernestine Rose, and others formed the National Women's Loyal League. They sent bundles of petitions calling for an end to slavery to abolitionist Senator Charles Sumner, who introduced the 13th Amendment. By August 1864, they collected 400,000 signatures. After the war, Northern women went south as teachers to free black slaves. Later, Southern women taught in newly established public schools. By the beginning of the 20th century, the majority of the nation's teachers were women. At the end of the Civil War, women were also firmly entrenched in office work, government service, and retail trade. The Civil War, as it did every facet of American society, altered the structure and goals of the feminist movement, which began to concentrate primarily on women's suffrage as the process through which every other form of equality would be certified. In May 1866, men and women from the American Anti-Slavery Society and women's rights groups joined forces to form the American Equal Rights Association in New York. With Lucretia Mott as president and Susan B. Anthony as corresponding secretary, the group began a campaign for suffrage for all African Americans and all women. Thousands of women signed a petition drafted by Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton that demanded Congress initiate a constitutional amendment to, quote, prohibit the several states from disenfranchising any of their citizens on the grounds of sex. Congress passed the 14th Amendment in 1866, and it was ratified in 1868. It stated that all persons born or naturalized in the United States were citizens and guaranteed due process and equal protection under the laws. However, another section referred to voting rights in terms of male citizens, the first time this qualification appeared in the Constitution. Stanton ran for Congress that year, though she was not allowed to vote, and although she received only 24 votes of 12,000 cast, she proved women had the right to campaign for public office. Stanton and Anthony formed the National Women's Suffrage Association, NWSA, to push for a constitutional amendment guaranteeing women the vote in 1869. Later that year, Lucy Stone, Julia Ward Howe, and others established a countergroup, the American Women's Suffrage Association, AWSA. The two groups were rivals for 20 years. The original NWSA was generally the more radical organization, advocating not just the vote, but also reforms in women's wages, working conditions, and property and divorce laws. The AWSA focused on women's suffrage, working at the state rather than federal level. In December 1869, Wyoming Territory granted women suffrage in its new constitution. The legislature also guaranteed married women rights to their own property and approved equal pay for male and female teachers. The following year, Utah Territory gave the vote to women, took it away in 1887, and restored it in 1896. Colorado's women got the vote in 1893 after prominent local socialites joined the state suffrage movement. By 1896, four contiguous states, Idaho, Wyoming, Colorado, and Utah, had full suffrage, but no other state would for 14 more years. In 1890, Congress attempted to deny Wyoming's application for statehood because it allowed women to vote, but in a close vote admitted it only as the only state in which women could vote in a federal election. Women pushed for their rights to vote in elections all over the country in the late 19th century, and Victoria Woodhull became the first woman to campaign for the presidency in 1872, forming her own Equal Rights Party. Susan B. Anthony and 16 other women were arrested in Rochester, New York that year when they tried to vote in the presidential elections. Anthony declared, "It is we, the people, not we, the white male citizens, nor we, the male citizens, but we, the whole people, who formed this union. We formed it not to give the blessings of liberty, but to secure them. Not to the half of ourselves and the half of our posterity, but to the whole people, women as well as men. It is downright mockery to talk to women of their enjoyment of the blessings of liberty while they are denied the only means of securing them provided by the Democratic Republican government, the ballot." Anthony and Stanton managed to get Congress to vote on a constitutional suffrage amendment in 1878. Called the Anthony Amendment, it was reintroduced every year for the next 41 years until it finally became the 19th Amendment. It states simply, "The right of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or any state on account of sex." The Senate waited 9 years to debate and vote on the Anthony Amendment, with 16 for, 34 against, and 26 absent in 1887. The Senate did nothing more until March 1914, when for the first time in 27 years the amendment was brought out of committee to vote on it again with 35 for and 34 against. That same year, activist teacher Harriet Rodman formed the Feminist Alliance, which demanded the removal of all social, political, and other discriminations which are based on sex, and the award of all rights and duties in all fields on the basis of individual capacity alone. After President Woodrow Wilson spoke out in favor of the Stanton Amendment in January 1918, the House passed the measure for the first time, 274 for, 136 against, just the two-thirds required majority. Despite a direct plea by Wilson, the Senate defeated it by two votes. In regard to state suffrage, by 1910, Oregon had failed to pass five such referendums, but that same year, Washington became the first state since 1896 to grant women the vote, approving the measure by almost 2-1. In 1911, suffragists mounted an intense campaign in California, and by 3,857 votes, the state's women won the right to cast their own ballots. In 1914, suffrage was on the ballot in seven states. Defeated in Missouri, Nebraska, Ohio, North and South Dakota, it won in Montana and Nevada. Four East Coast states voted down suffrage in 1915. They were Massachusetts, New Jersey, New York, and Pennsylvania. 2 years later, New York overturned the earlier vote and became the first East Coast state to grant women suffrage. Also that year, 1917, women gained the right to vote after legislative action in six states, Indiana, Michigan, Nebraska, North Dakota, Ohio, and Rhode Island. They also won the right to vote in primaries in Arkansas, Michigan, Oklahoma, and South Dakota gained full suffrage the following year. And in Texas, women were allowed to vote in primaries through legislative action, though literacy tests prevented many black and Mexican-American women from voting. The U.S. House approved the 19th Amendment in May 1919, 304-89, after a lame duck Senate defeated it in February that year. The Senate finally reversed its long rejection to women's suffrage in June with a vote of 66-30. Within 1 week, three states, Wisconsin, Illinois, and Michigan, ratified the amendment, and by the end of the year, more than 20 states had passed the measure. By the end of March 1920, 35 of the required 36 states had ratified the amendment. A single vote in the Tennessee House of Representatives in August, Harry Byrne, whose mother was a suffragist and told him to be a good boy and vote for ratification, gave the U.S. Constitution its 19th Amendment, which was declared official on August 26th. Two other states, Vermont and Connecticut, ratified it later. 10 states did not ratify the 19th Amendment. They were Alabama, Delaware, Florida, Georgia, Louisiana, Maryland, Mississippi, Virginia, North and South Carolina. Of the 38 states that approved the amendment, more than three-fourths needed to pass it. Throughout the suffrage struggle, America's history, her principles, her traditions, stood forth to indicate the inevitability of women's suffrage. Yet the years went by, decade followed decade, and 26 other countries gave the vote to their women while America delayed. Carrie Chapman Catt and Nettie Rogers Schuler wrote in their 1923 book, Women's Suffrage and Politics, The Inner Story of the Suffrage Movement. Why the delay? We think we have the answer. It was not an antagonistic public sentiment, nor yet an uneducated or indifferent public sentiment. It was the control of public sentiment, the deflecting and the thwarting of public sentiment, through the trading and the trickery, the buying and the selling of American politics. We think that we can prove it. All issues are women's issues, Geraldine Ferraro said the year she campaigned as vice president on the Democratic ticket, 1984, which is exactly the point of this chronology. Only a partial account of women's role in the structure of American history, but an example of the depth and complexity of that participation. Debbie Twombly, a founding member of the North Coast Women's History Project, wrote in the North Coast Times-Eagle in March 1989, "During recent years, women have reached into the past to gain a hold on our roots. The results have been an affirmation of our worth and finally a documentation of the contributions of our foremothers. History lessons have basically taught children that women have been invisible in the development of our country, but gradually women are being written back into history. As we learn more, surely a positive reaction will be the gradual awareness that women have always been a part of our past, and girls will begin to feel worthy of a place in history. Optimally, we will come to realize that women can reach the historical heights that men have kept for themselves." And that was our own Debbie Twombly. And what I just read was something I wrote, Ms. Smith Goes to Washington. And indispensable to this article has been Timelines of American Women's History by Sue Heinemann. Thanks also to Gerda Lerner for her 1971 book, The Woman in American History, and many others for which there is no room to list as a bibliography. And this article, Ms. Smith Goes to Washington, originally appeared in the summer 1997 issue of the North Coast Times-Eagle and has been slightly revised and updated for broadcast. And so it could fit into this half hour. It was a much longer article. And before I sign off for the week, I'd like to sort of reminisce that two men I've not seen for many years, one since 1974, showed up in Astoria this week and took me to lunch. One pushed a wheeled walker, and the other had use of a cane. He surprised me immensely. When we were younger, he was a large, imposing man of fiercely inspired physical and mental force. His shape and persona appear to have shrunk. He seems now to be a benign and kindly elder. His intelligence and memory seem unimpaired, and neither he nor my other visitor have relented in their political or cultural beliefs that engulfed our turbulent youth. I have not either, for the most part. My ideas about malfeasance, corruption, and folly were forged in a long-ago war. And thinking of the article that I just read a few moments ago, something I just found I had scribbled down here. In 2008, I was torn between a white woman and a black man for the presidency, all the while ardently wishing Barbara Jordan, who was both black and a woman, and from Texas, was still alive. For that matter, Ann Richards, former governor of Texas, would also have been a fine choice, but she was also dead by then. Either of them would have been distinctly preferable to the political swamp gas we have all been mired in this past decade and a half. That was just something I discovered I had scribbled in the margin, which most of the things I write are quite often filled with. Well, this has been Michael McCusker, and perhaps I will see you next week if the wind and rain doesn't blow me away, or if I don't get, you might say, knocked down by a drone doing one thing or another. You've been listening to A Story Told. I'm Michael McCusker.